Hi again. Today I want to talk about characteristics of people who abuse others and characteristics of people who are abused by others. Now, we sort of ended last time with that kind of overview of the lifespan with questions about that, because it does seem like there's a lot of diversity in when you think about different kinds of abuse. And the question I want to put on the table today is, are there some generalizations that are possible? First, let's talk about the abused. And there has been a great deal of study in general about people who have been abused, looking for example, common personality traits and characteristics. And the conclusion is pretty simple, is that there are no such common traits. This may or may not be obvious to you. If you think about it a while, I think it seems certainly plausible. The dilemma for people who've experienced abuse is that it's often experienced as an unintelligible kind of event, like an incomprehensible kind of thing that has happened, and you ask these why questions, and it feels like some explanation is necessary to make sense out of this sort of traumatically disorganized experience in life. And in an effort to come up with an explanation for what's happened, we may think, well, there's something about me that is the reason why this happened. And I really want to emphasize that there's no evidence at all to suggest that it's true, that anyone can be abused. It is true that some people are at higher risk of being abused than other people, and I'm going to talk about that for a while, but I want to emphasize ahead of time that being at risk for abuse is a completely different frame of reference than whether or not you're responsible for abuse. Some people think that because they're at risk, they are therefore responsible when abuse happens. And I think once you lean into an ethical frame thinking about abuse, it's really important to make the person responsible for the abuse be the person who does the abuse, not the person who's at risk for being abused. So there's this emphasis on the abuser as the one who's responsible for the abuse. But there are such things as risk factors. And this is just one, I'm going to quickly run through one sort of frame of reference for thinking about risk factors, and here the focus is largely childhood abuse, principally childhood sexual abuse, and the suggestion is that there's four kinds of risk factors in the parents, in the child, in the family in a larger sense, and in the community. And just let me say a few things about those different risk factors. Parental risk factors for childhood abuse are things like young age of parent, children having children is a risk factor for the children being abused. Single parents are at higher risk, and a child, the result of an unwanted pregnancy, is at higher risk. Poor parenting skills, early exposure to violence, certainly substance abuse, a very high risk factor for child abuse. Inadequate prenatal care, physical or mental illness, and relationship problems are all things that are basically about the parent that might make them at risk of becoming abusive towards their children. Now, the child, being confused by behavior of this kind from a parent, might think it's about me, but all these are risk factors that are about the parent, not about the child. Now, there are some risk factors in kids. There's the gender of a child. This is something the child has, you know, no control over, but it is a risk factor. Female children are at higher risk than male children for most kinds of childhood abuse, including childhood sexual abuse. Prematurity is again something that a child has no impact on. It's all about fatened factors, but having been born prematurely and with all the complications sometimes involved in that, increases the risk of childhood abuse. Being the result of an unwanted pregnancy, again, not really something that is under the control at all of the child, is also a risk factor. And finally, any kind of physical disability, physical or mental or psychological disability, is a risk factor for being abused. Risk factors in the family include quite a variety of things: the size and density of the family, poor socioeconomic status, social isolation, high stress levels, family abuse or history of domestic violence in the family systems, or many family systems where the child is at high risk just because they're part of that family, because the family has, abuse has been like water to a fish in the family for generations. So you're just kind of set up for some kind of abuse being a part of that family. Again, that's not a characteristic of the abused child. It's just they happen to be born into a family with a long history, high susceptibility, high risk for the kids being abused. And then there's factors related to the community that pose risks. If there's non-existent or under-enforced child protection laws, this is not a small issue. There's quite a range and quality of child protection laws, and quite a range in the extent to which such laws are enforced in different jurisdictions. There's kind of a more general factor in the community as to whether children are valued. It's not that long ago in our history that children were simply property. And this seems quite appalling to us now, and I think appropriately so. But to the extent to which children are seen as non-essential, as problems rather than a blessing, these kinds of things have an impact on the extent to which children will be at risk for abuse. Social inequality has a very significant community risk factor. Certainly organized violence, wars, and high crime rates are risk factors for kids being abused. The high social acceptance of violence, high social acceptance of violence where the violence is somehow not noticed. It becomes part of the entertainment, it becomes part of the every aspect of culture becomes entangled with violent imagery, violent ideation. It becomes just like water to a fish for us, so that it's not noticed particularly. That poses a very significant risk factor for children. And again, media violence, cultural norms that accept, there are certainly plenty of examples of cultures where physical violence towards children is just a norm. It's reasonably common in the United States, but there are other places around the world where it's even more common, where it's thought to be sort of necessary part of having a good childhood is to get beat up a lot by your parents. Now, there's a danger in suggesting that there are risk factors, because there's going to be some people who meet all this who experience a lot of risk factors. In fact, most people who could look through these list of risk factors are not going to abuse their kids. So a single mom with poor social economic status, living in a culture that doesn't particularly value kids, in a family with a long history of abuse of kids, may turn out to be a very healthy parent and protect her kids from harm. So there's nothing about risk factors that imply in any particular case that the kid's going to be at risk. The World Health Organization, which is where this list of risk factors came from, talks about it in this way. Theories that propose single factors or combinations of risk factors as invariably leading directly to child abuse will stigmatize families which fall within the profile and lead to missed cases of child abuse which do not fit the profile. I think this is a very important footnote about the whole notion of risk factors. It's very, very difficult to predict, even if you know, even if you can identify a lot of risk factors. It's very, very difficult to do any predictive kind of work about child abuse or other kinds of abuse. Sometimes people where there are no risk factors, no identifiable risk factors of any kind, will find themselves engaged in abusive behavior. And that's part of the confusing mix of things here. We do not really understand, I think, all that well, all the factors that go into predisposing people towards abuse. Now, there are some issues about people who have been abused that come up very frequently, and I'm just going to hint at some here. We don't have time to get in this in depth, although I may come back to this particular issue a little bit later. The first has to do with the question of whether people who are abused as children are more likely to be abused as adults. And I think, more significant question that sort of underlies that question is, if this is true, and I think actually there's reasonably good evidence to suggest that having been abused puts one at risk for being abused later, maybe not in the same way, but in other kinds of ways. But if this is true, doesn't that make them kind of responsible? And the analogy here is, say, a victim of domestic violence who keeps going back to be with their abuser, making the choice to engage in the relationship again. Spouses in serially monogamous relations with alcoholics or drug addicts. A woman marries an alcoholic. The relation falls apart, there's a divorce, they swear on a stack of Bibles they'll never marry another alcoholic, and they marry another alcoholic. I mean, this is almost a cliché in Al-Anon groups, at least. The question is whether one acquires some responsibility for the problem by finding oneself repeatedly in a position where one is being abused. And the answer is, wow, this is really complicated. It is, I think, quite indisputable that if we fail to do the work that needs to be done to heal from traumatic experiences, we are partially responsible for being at risk for being hurt again. And exactly what the nature of that responsibility is, it doesn't diminish in any way, I think, the primary responsibility of the abusive person, but it really goes not so much to it doesn't really bring any clarity if the question you're asking is who's to blame here, because the question of who's to blame is always, there's always plenty of blame, more enough to go around for everybody. The question really goes to the complexity of abusive entanglements. That when you start to tease out exactly how we got into this mess, you find all kinds of threads, all kinds of complications, all kinds of pathways that work together to make this happen. And that's why the healing journey, which we'll talk about later in the class, is also very complicated. There's, often, as I've already mentioned, this sort of accumulation of abusive experiences that we collect within us. So it's not just typically a single abusive event. But most of us who have experienced abuse find ourselves having experienced sort of adapted ourselves to abusive environments over often very long periods of time. And that sort of adaptation is also very complicated, because the adaptations we make to an abusive childhood, for example, may have saved our life as kids. My basic adaptation in childhood was to disappear. I learned by the age of 6 or 7 to disappear. And in my family, it was I don't know that it saved my life, but it may have saved my sanity to have that kind of ninja-like ability to disappear at a very early age. But of course, later in life, it's that same capability of disappearing that made a mess of a variety of important relationships in my life, where disappearing was not a skill that was going to be very helpful. It certainly got in the way of intimate relationships in a big way. And it took me a long time to learn how to show up rather than to disappear. Okay, I'm kind of rambling here a bit. I just want to suggest that when you start to ask, does the experience of having been abused lead us into situations where we're likely to be abused again? I think the answer is probably, for most of us, yes. And a lot hinges on how we respond to abuse, what resources are made available to us when we have been abused, you know, whether the toxic experience sort of finds a place within us to fester for 20 or 30 years, and then you have it sort of messing up all different kinds of things inside of us. Okay, we will come back to this later. I really want to move on to say a little bit about abusers and what we know about abusers. And here, the situation is, if anything, much more complicated. Let me read to you what Judith Herman, in the book you're reading, says about abusers. Little is known about the mind of the perpetrator. Since he is contemptuous of those who seek to understand him, he does not volunteer to be studied. Since he does not perceive that anything is wrong with him, he does not seek help, unless he's in trouble with the law. His most consistent feature in both the testimony of victims and the observations of psychologists is his apparent normality. Ordinary concepts of psychopathology fail to define or comprehend him. This struck me when I first read it as the most insightful comment about abusers that I have ever read. It matched very well my own experience of knowing some people who had abused others, that they seem like perfectly normal people. Never would have guessed, and this is the consistent testimony of many, many people who... it's very common to experience a sense of betrayal when you find out that someone has abused others, because they presented themselves as, you know, really normal and kind of engaging and nice. And I remember the first time I met a pedophile. My experience was he seemed like a really quite delightful human being. And this was even knowing that he had been convicted for molesting young boys. He seemed like a very engaging. I thought he had substantially better social skills than I had. There would be no way to have guessed ahead of time about this. That's part, of course, of pedophiles, the skill set necessary to be successful at being a pedophile, is you have to build a lot of trust in a lot of different people in order to get done what you hope to get done. Now, the other thing about abusers that's, I think, pretty important is I do think we all tend to carry within us preconceptions about what people are like who abuse other people, that they're mean, that they're sociopathic, or they're that guy in the trench coat at the public park, they're strangers, or they're kind of really weird, disordered, mentally ill people. And all the evidence suggests quite to the contrary, that there's nothing about them that you would notice as out of the ordinary. And furthermore, I think there's an increasing emphasis on the fact that abusers are not a single kind of person. Let me just read you a quote from Beverly Burns. Researchers and clinicians no longer view abuse and neglect as a monolithic problem. Accordingly, it will never be possible to come up with one profile of the maltreating parent. Parents who neglect their kids because they are depressed and have too few emotional, cognitive, or financial resources are clearly different from those who inflict serious injury on their children, and these in turn are quite different from incestuous parents. So it's not, and I think going over the lifespan last time hopefully gave you a sense of that, that the people who are the perpetrators of abuse don't fit in just sort of all in one sort of preconceived notion of what the psychology might be like. Herman's very clear that traditional psychological categories don't turn out to be very helpful here in understanding someone whose behavior you would really like to be able to understand, but they defy simple categorization. And I think that makes it frustrating to be working with perpetrators. There's a variety of different ways to understand why abusers abuse. And let me just pick a couple to talk about. There must be, I don't know, dozens and dozens of theories about this. One is that it's a kind of cognitive problem at its root, that people have cognitive distortions that get manifested in their behaviors. And, you know, there's a whole school of psychology that would emphasize this way of thinking things. And here is some clues, some suggestions by some people studying child sex abusers about the core cognitive distortions that they observe in perpetrators of childhood sexual abuse. The first is children are viewed as sexual objects. Not just gendered objects, but sexual objects. And the conviction that children, like adults, are motivated by a desire for pleasure and are capable of enjoying and desiring sex. To the vast majority of us, just reading that, you say, boy, that's a really, really strange cognition. That's a strange thought. It doesn't seem to be informed by child development, by common sense. It's a very distorted cognition, and indeed it is. But it's a very common one among people who sexually abuse kids. Secondly, there's a sense of entitlement. It's really a conviction that the desires and beliefs of the abuser are most important, are paramount, and those of the victim should be ignored somehow. That's also a very troubling cognition. It's very narcissistic. I can tell you what this sounds like for pastors who are in deep trouble, because it's a narrative I've heard a lot. What entitlement sounds like? It sounds like, I've been giving my all in the ministry all these years. I have held nothing back from God. I have been totally committed to the work of the kingdom. And I didn't ever worry about getting anything back for me. But now there's just this one thing that is for me. And I feel like I'm entitled to one thing. Well, the one things might be having sex with the church secretary, you know? That's the kind of context in which I've heard that narrative. And you can hear the cognitive distortion there, I think. It is, the narrative is not presented as having failed to do appropriate self-care for the last 25 years and been sort of addictively entangled in ministry. I now find myself dying, you know, way over my head and dying from it. It's, I've been giving and giving and giving, and I just need this one thing that feels like God's gift to me. So it's very distorted cognitively, and some people would say there's the root of the problem right there, that cognitive distortion. Thirdly, the sense of being in a dangerous world. You're kind of on your own. No one's going to help you. No one's going to be there for you. You have to take care of yourself. And that sort of isolation that comes out of the sense of there's a sense of abandonment there, abandonment, isolation, existential angst, whatever you want to talk about that, is another cognitive distortion really common among child sexual abusers. Uncontrollability, there's a paradoxical character to this, since people who abuse children often are trying to control everything, but it sort of comes out of an inner experience of uncontrollability. I can't control outcomes here. I can't make things work out. and I feel helpless and vulnerable. And so I'm going to have to, at least in some part of my life, exercise enormous amounts of control. You see the same thing in domestic, in relationships characterized by domestic violence. Someone who feels very incapable of controlling life in any way will make sure that they control this part of life. I should be able to come home, and dinner should be on the table, and the meatloaf should not be undercooked, or someone will pay a price. Okay, so I'm going to control this piece to make sure that there's some part of my life where I feel like I'm in charge. And finally, the sort of cognitive perception of what constitutes harm tends to be very distorted in people who hurt children. For child sexual abusers, there's often the sense that they are doing something beneficial, something that's unlikely to harm. They'll tell you that they're being as loving as they know how to be, as caring as they know how to be, and how dare you think of what they're doing as harmful. What is wrong with you that you would interpret my loving actions in such a negative way? Okay, so that's a very deeply entrenched cognitive distortions, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate frame for thinking about why abusers abuse, that it's rooted in these deeply held convictions about reality. But I'm not quite as optimistic about the prospects of challenging cognitive distortions among people who abuse others in the hopes that they'll change, because this stuff is really very deeply entrenched, and there is some good evidence that cognitive behavior therapy can be helpful with people who abuse others, but it's a complicated matter beyond the scope of this class to talk about that in detail. The second theory that I want you at least think about is that it's kind of a moral theory for why abusers abuse. Listen to this dialogue between a counselor and a client. The counselor says, did you ever think you might be sick? The client says, yes. The counselor, so I've got news for you, you're not sick at all, not one bit. Client, but then how could I do that? If I'm not sick, why did I do it? Counselor, I told you, you did it because you thought it would feel good, and it did feel good, so you did it again and again. That doesn't make you sick, it makes you evil. Now, if you're in training in the school of psychology or in any sort of training to be a counselor, they're going to do at great lengths to encourage you to not lean in this direction of seeing things in a moral frame. Let me suggest that if you're going to be working with people who abuse others, you're going to find yourself sooner or later asking questions like this, where the boundaries between psychological health and evil become pretty elusive. That people do evil things because they want to do evil things, and I'm not a big fan of. I'm not a big fan of cognitive behavioral approaches to working with abusers, although there's some evidence that that's helpful. I'm also not a huge fan of sort of moralizing. This actually doesn't strike me as moralizing. This is asking a client to enter an ethical frame and to figure out for themselves whether this is okay or not. Now, most people, the great many abusers are, of course, sociopaths and simply can't go there, but that's the exception rather than the rule. I think most people who abuse others are profoundly confused by why they did what they did. And having a capacity to go with them through the kind of moral analysis to figure out how they got here and in what ways is it legitimate to talk in a moral sense about this strikes me as potentially a very important part of the healing process. I realize that's a very complicated issue, and it's not easy to do, because after all, most of us in working with people who have abused others may show up for the conversation with an enormous amount of judgment and rejection and shame to offer. And if we do that, then leading towards a moral frame will probably just lead to more shame, more judgment, and more harm done to the abused, the abusive person. But if we don't bring that with us, if we can't stay client-centered with the abuser when we're working with abusers, I think we should not hesitate to have conversations in a moral frame of reference. Again, be happy to talk about that more in the forum, because it is not a simple matter. A third kind of way to answer the question why abusers abuse is, there's a good model for this in the case of pedophilia. This is a review article about pedophilia by David Finkelhor, one of the best known researchers in the area of childhood sexual abuse. And this is his summary. I think it's kind of a good model for the range of considerations that you might want to give in asking why abusers abuse. Again, this is just about child sexual abuse, but think of it in a general sort of way. He sort of has a sensibility that there's two things. The first thing has to do with motivation. You have to be motivated to sexually abuse a child, and that has some components to it. And then there's a certain behavioral skill set, really. You have to have certain skills to be able to do that. About motivation, he says there's three elements to that. There has to be some kind of emotional congruence to us. I mean, most of us thinking about having sex with a child, there's no emotional congruence to that. It's just horrifying transparently obvious that it's hurtful. But for someone who is having sexual relations with a child, there has to be some kind of, inside of them, there has to be some kind of emotional congruence. It has to make sense somehow inside of them. And what all goes into that is very complicated. In many cases, I have the suspicion that there's a lot of childhood trauma that sets a person up for, and a lack of ability to sexually bond with people of their own age, but focus on very young children. The second issue has to do with sexual arousal. It's not just a matter of having an emotional congruence in thinking about sexual relations with a child. There has to be actual some capacity for sexual arousal around that. Again, that's a pretty complicated matter. How does that take place, and what goes into that? I mean, for people who have not experienced this, it's probably unimaginable. But if you wanted to be helpful to people struggling with this, you'd want to know something about that. And finally, what he calls blockage, that is, there's the motivation to have sex with children might come from the sense that there are things in the way of any other kind of viable sexual expression. So it's kind of sexual expression of last resort in some cases, or the only safe kind of sexual expression, safe for the abuser. So there's a lot of things that go into the motivational state of the person who abuses. This is true of all different kinds of abuse. It's important to ask, I think. It's legitimate to ask, what's the motivation here? And second, there has to be some skill sets. In the case of pedophilia, it's quite remarkable the range of social skills and other kinds of skills that are necessary. You have to overcome normal internal inhibitions. Okay, so a pedophile is not just someone who is attracted to having sex with young children. It's someone who, in all probably, resists that, doesn't like that, at the least is ambivalent about that, but is able to overcome those inhibitions in one way or another. Sometimes there's substances involved to get over that sort of natural resistance to this. Secondly, they have to be able to overcome whatever external inhibitions there are, whatever getting in the way. This might be, you have to overcome, you have to have some access to kids, right? So you need to be trusted by other people in order to have access to kids. So you need to become the kind of person who other people trust. Now, nobody trusts the guy in the trench coat in the park, right? So you don't want to be like that guy. You want to be the nicest guy on the block. You want to be someone that other people would trust letting their kids come over to your house. You want to be the Boy Scout leader, the Sunday school leader, someone that is trusted by other people. It's not unheard of for pedophiles to marry single parents in order to get access to their children. That shows an extraordinary capacity for, setting the stage, for doing the arrangements so that you're thinking way ahead of the game here about how are you going to have access to the children that you want to have sexual relationships with. Finally, you have to overcome a child's resistance to this. Now, depending on the age of the child, in most cases for young children, they haven't the slightest idea what's going on when they're being sexually abused. They don't know what this is about. And they may be being given lots of different narratives about what's going on. This is because I love you and care about you. This is very special and just between the two of us. All those kinds of narratives which, have to be seen for what they are later in the healing process. But they, that ability to overcome a kid's instinctive sense that something's wrong here by acquiring the trust of children is part of what pedophiles do. Now, the only risk I've taken here is just talk too much about sexual abuse of kids and pedophiles, which is a very small percentage of the total problem, even of childhood sexual abuse. Most abusers of children are not pedophiles, and they're not typically strangers. They're friends, they're parents, and so on. Finally, I just want to say a few words about, because I think it's particularly important in pastoral ministry, what sensibility you have about hope for people who abuse others. And this data I'm going to give you is about, about child sexual abuse, which seems to be the focus for the day. But here is a summary analysis of almost 80 different studies involving 11,000 offenders. Overall, treated offenders reoffended at a rate of 11%. Okay, so roughly 1 in 10 people who were, this population, if I recall correctly, was all people who were involved with the criminal justice system in one way or another. They're on parole, typically, or serve their sentences and back out. The overall rate of recidivism of being caught and in the criminal justice system again for sexual abuse was 1 in 10. 1 in 10 people did that. Of people who got some kind of treatment. The rate was higher, 17%, 17.6% of people who had no treatment at all. So most people who are found guilty of sexual abuse of a child do not reoffend. The vast majority of people do not reoffend. At least they do not reoffend in such a way that they wind up back in the criminal justice system. A big unknown there, whether there's offending behavior that's didn't get them back in the criminal justice system. An interesting observation in this meta-study was that men treated before 1980 reoffended at a rate much higher than men who reoffended after treatment after 1980. Present-day methods, sort of post-1980, reoffended at a rate of 7%. So the odds that a sex offender is going to reoffend if they've been through a modern treatment program is, you know, at 7%. Now, how you respond to the number 7% or 10% is a really complicated question. I don't really intend to offer much advice about that. I know that for some people, 7% means, man, we can't tell which 7% that is. We should lock them all up. And other people are going to think, well, 7% isn't very high. We may want to be watching folks, but we don't want to assume, because 7% reoffend, that the 93%, we don't want to stigmatize the 93% because of the 7%. Now, this becomes an issue for the local church, because you are going to have registered sex offenders as members of your congregation. I know that probably like me, when I was in seminary, you were hoping to go to seminary and be called to serve a nice church full of nice people. And there might be a good deal of cognitive dissonance associated with me saying quite so simply, you will have people who abuse others in your congregation. I think it's an inescapable, the demographics suggest that it's the case. In fact, the more you resist this, the more likely it is that you'll create a congregation that feels safe for people who abuse others, because they'll think that you're, you know, making the assumption that abusive people are not here. If I were a pedophile, I'd go to a place that didn't pay much attention to this issue. I'd probably try to avoid places where people were talking about this, struggling with this issue, trying to find resources that are helpful. Now, I will tell you how congregations typically tend to respond to people who abuse others when it's found out, whether it's domestic violence, child sexual abuse, or what have you. Typically what happens, in spite of whatever theological frame of reference the congregation is in, there's some sort of strategy that in the end results in that person leaving. And, I'll give you an example. This is about a phone call. This is quite a number of years ago now, from a congregation that had three pastors in a row resigned because of inappropriate and abusive sexual relations with someone in the congregation. And they after each incident, they told themselves the last thing we're ever going to do is hire someone that's susceptible to this problem, and which they, you know, proceeded to do. It wasn't that there was a problem with their intentions, it was a problem with their radar detector for people with these kinds of problems. And more than that, every time a pastor went through a failure, they sent a message to all the people in the congregation who were struggling, in this case, with sexual issues. And the message is this: if you get found out like this person got found out, we don't want you here. We don't want people like you here. And that meant that these people in the congregation who struggled with these kinds of issues, committed themselves to extra efforts to not get noticed here, you know, to keep their stuff secret. So the congregation as a whole was becoming sicker and sicker as a result of their efforts to find the pastor who was untainted by sin. We would be far further along in the game if we found ways to tell the truth about this, that hurting other people is pretty common among broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark people like us. And what we need to do is to develop ways to be distributors of grace when people fail in different kinds of ways. That doesn't mean sort of nice, try harder and You know, it needs to be a much more robust response than that, which feels just like turning a blind eye to things. But if we can continue just to shame and blame, which I think is the most instinctive, natural, and understandable response to people who commit atrocities, to people who abuse other people, is to, you know, want nothing to do with them, to banish them, to have them go away. It feels very shaming that they're here. And as long as we insist on being congregations where, you know, sinners need not apply, rather than developing the kind of recovery strategies and healing strategies that could take people who are broken, damaged, hurting, struggling, missing the mark people, and help them grow into maturity in Christ. The longer it will be until we, you know, start offering really graceful church experiences. Okay, I hope there's enough in that for you to chew on a bit and talk about the forum. So I'll see you there. Look forward to talking to you. Bye.